Please be safe, whatever you do.
This is VOA News. Reporting via remote, I'm Richard Green. Gunmen have attacked a major Shiite holy site in Iran, killing at least 15 people and wounding dozens. Wednesday's attack came as thousands of protesters elsewhere in Iran marked a symbolic 40 days since a woman's death in custody ignited the biggest anti-government movement in over a decade. State TV blamed the attack on Sunni Muslim extremists who have targeted the country's Shiite majority in the past. It appeared to be unrelated to the demonstrations. The official website of the judiciary says two gunmen were arrested and a third is on the run after the attack on the Shah Cheikh Mosque, the second holiest site in Iran. The Islamic State group late Wednesday claimed responsibility for the attack. Russian President Vladimir Putin has overseen drills of Russia's nuclear forces, AP correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
Putin's monitored the country's multiple practice launches of ballistic and cruise missiles in a show of force amid the heightened tensions with the West over the conflict in Ukraine. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu says the drills are intended to simulate a massive nuclear strike by Russia in retaliation for a nuclear attack on Russia. The maneuvers followed Putin's warning about his readiness to use all means available to fend off attacks on Russia's territory in a clear reference to the country's nuclear arsenal. As a part of the exercise, Tu-95 bombers also launched cruise missiles at practice targets. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
NATO is carrying out its own long-planned annual nuclear exercises in northwestern Europe. On the battlefront, Russian forces targeted more than 40 villages in Ukraine. The Los Angeles City Council formally rebuked two members and its former president for their involvement in a racism scandal that has shaken public faith in a city hall. This is VOA News. Wednesday's 12-0 vote to censure former Council President Nuri Martinez and Councilman Gil Cedillo and Kevin De Leon represented the strongest steps the Council can take to publicly reprimand the three for their participation in a secretly recorded 2021 meeting laced with crude, bigoted comments. The three Latino Democrats were heard scheming to protect their political clout in the redrawing of Council districts at the expense of blacks and renters. Martinez resigned shortly after the release of the tape earlier this month. Rishi Sunak, who is of Indian heritage, has become Britain's first non-white prime minister. As Henry Ridgewell reports for VOA from London, some in Britain are comparing it to the election of Barack Obama as the first black U.S. president.
Rishi Sunak is the first British Asian to lead the country, a milestone welcomed by all sides of the House at Prime Minister's questions Wednesday. Keir Starmer is leader of the opposition Labour Party.
It's a reminder that for all the challenges we face as a country, Britain is a place where people of all races and all beliefs can fulfil their dreams.
Some have described this as Britain's Obama moment. Analyst Anand Menon, a professor of politics at King's College London, who, like Sunak, is of Indian heritage, rejects the comparison.
Because of the way Sunak was elected, he was chosen by MPs as a leader of a party. Barack Obama gained a personal mandate from the American people by being elected president.
It is, nevertheless, a significant moment. Again, Professor Anand Menon.
That you see someone who is of South Asian heritage, who is a practicing Hindu, having the highest political office in the land, that matters.
Rishi Sunak's term in office may not be so prolonged, with at most 2 years until the next election. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Germany set out plans on Wednesday to legalize cannabis, a move Chancellor Olaf Scholz's government said would make Germany one of the first countries in Europe to do so. The coalition government struck an agreement last year to introduce legislation during its four-year term to allow the controlled distribution of cannabis in licensed shops. Health Minister Karl Lauterbach did not give a timeline for the plan. Many countries of the region have already legalized cannabis for limited medicinal purposes, including Germany since 2017. Recapping our top story, gunmen have attacked a major Shiite holy site in Iran, killing at least 15 people and wounding dozens of others. Wednesday's attack came as thousands of protesters elsewhere in Iran marked a symbolic 40 days since a woman's death in custody ignited the biggest anti-government movement in over a decade. You can find more on this story and all the stories we're covering at voanews.com. Reporting via remote, I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Today is Thursday, October 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, NATO and Russian forces hold annual nuclear drills as Americans worry about a nuclear war over Ukraine.
A vast majority of adults polled by the American Psychological Association said they fear the beginning stages of World War III.
Pakistan places security forces on alert ahead of a protest by its former prime minister and his supporters.
The government has warned Imran Khan that his march will not be allowed to enter the capital city. And secondly, 30,000 police and paramilitary forces have already been deployed.
And at least 15 people killed and dozens injured as gunmen attack a major Shiite holy site in Iran. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. NATO and Russian military alike are staging planned annual nuclear exercises. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday remotely monitored the drills of his strategic nuclear forces, including multiple practice missile launches. The exercises simulated a massive nuclear strike retaliating for a nuclear attack on Russia. NATO is carrying out its own long-planned nuclear exercises in northwestern Europe. On the battlefront, Russian forces targeted more than 40 villages in Ukraine as Kyiv continues its counteroffensive. The possibility of Russia launching a nuclear attack in Ukraine and beyond has some Americans on edge. Some are going online to see what that means. Anxiety is up, but experts say panic isn't justified, at least not yet. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports.
She describes them as scary, but those threats that Russia might go nuclear in Ukraine aren't yet part of Jonah Wilson's chatter with friends.
No, we're probably talking about our Spotify playlist if we're not in class. Our grandparents and parents who may have grown up during the Cold War era, I felt like the precipice of anxiety was a bit higher for that generation.
Those old worries seem to be making a comeback. A vast majority of adults polled by the American Psychological Association said they fear the beginning stages of World War III.
Back in March of 2022, 69% of Americans said that they were stressed that the attack on the Ukraine could lead to nuclear war. It's unclear exactly what the sense of threat is, whether individuals really think that it's going to hit the shores of the United States versus this sense of, just catastrophic changes in the world.
These days, the potential consequences of a nuke, including deaths and contamination, can be easily visualized with a click of a button. Go online, select a bomb, map the target, and detonate. Alex Wellerstein, creator of the nuke map, spoke with VOA via Skype.
The traffic in the nuke map has gone up to essentially the highest it's ever been in 10 years. You have a lot of people in the United States and in Europe in particular who are trying to find out what nuclear weapon use might look like.
The hypothetical results are worrying, but fears about Russian President Vladimir Putin acting on his nuclear threats are overblown, says William Alberg, an expert on nuclear proliferation.
I don't think he would mobilize hundreds of thousands of troops at massive cost to the Russian economy and use nuclear weapons. It would be one or the other. The massive political and economic costs, in addition to military costs that Russia would incur, use all combined to make any nuclear use scenario by Russia seem very, very remote at this time.
Melvin Hardy curated the Hiroshima Children's Drawings exhibit at the Phillips Collection Museum in Washington, D.C. Japanese kids who survived did the work 2 years after the first atomic strike. Some are still alive. Their scars, physical and mental, a reminder of the horror. Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Washington.
When Russia troops fled the Ukrainian town of Balakia in September, they left behind thousands of documents that detailed the inner workings of the Russia war machine. Francisca Linaga of Reuters has more.
In September 2022, Russian forces fled the Ukrainian town of Balaklia. But they left their traces everywhere. One of them is this abandoned building, which the Russians used as a military base during their occupation of Balaklia. It was here that Reuters discovered thousands of documents, revealing the inner workings of the Russian military. Inside, posters reading, "Do not smoke, do not litter. If we leave, they will come." Notebooks and loose papers showing coordinates of Russian intelligence units, records of calls from commanders, details of battles, names of men killed, equipment destroyed, and accounts of a breakdown in morale and discipline. In all, Reuters reviewed more than 1,000 pages of documents. They shed new light on events leading up to one of President Vladimir Putin's most stinging battlefield defeats, Russia's chaotic retreat from Ukraine's northeast in September.
Slava Ukraine!
In early March 2022, Russian troops occupied the small riverside town of Balaklia. They took over a run-down vehicle repair complex on the outskirts of town and turned it into the command center for Balaklia and dozens of surrounding villages and farms. It was here in the basement that Reuters found the document cache. They show that in the weeks before the defeat, the Russian troops were struggling with surveillance and electronic warfare. They were using off-the-shelf drones flown by barely trained soldiers, and their equipment for jamming Ukrainian communications was often out of action. By the end of July, Russian officers were convinced Ukrainian forces were preparing a counter-offensive to take control of Balaklia, the documents show. The Balaklia command set about drafting in more troops. But a spreadsheet dated August 30th showed that the force was at only 71% of full strength. Another spreadsheet tracked equipment. The force had 4 Faggot anti-tank weapon systems left, down from 24. By the end of August, the force was depleted, hit by death, desertions, and combat stress.
That's Francisca Lenaga, Reuters. As the U.S. military considers China military strength in the Indo-Pacific region, the U.S. Navy is turning to driverless ships to multiply its forces. VOA's Jessica Stone takes us along for a closer look at its military innovation.
These 4 unmanned ships are among the newest additions to the U.S. Navy. Meet Sea Hunter, Seahawk, Nomad, and Ranger. This summer, the Navy gave VOA special access to photograph them for the first time.
There is no water. There are no toilets. They are only meant to be driven in and out of port by a human for obvious safety reasons.
U.S. Naval Commander Jeremiah Daly, permitted to give VOA an audio-only interview, leads the first division made up of remotely operated ships or drone boats. Daly says these unmanned vessels currently being piloted could one day enable the Navy to better patrol the vast 165 million square kilometers of the Pacific Ocean. Japan, Singapore, South Korea, and China all have programs to develop driverless ships. Former top Pentagon Asia official Randy Shriver says drone boats are critical to maintain a free and open Indo-Pacific in the face of an expanding and assertive Chinese military.
The spaces that are contested are certainly growing, and I think autonomous or unmanned vehicles, either submerged or on the surface, are cheaper. They're more expendable in terms of not risking the lives of sailors.
James Siebens, a defense strategy fellow at the Stimson Center, worries that these vessels could make a more attractive military target.
China, for one, might regard an unmanned vessel as a less escalatory target to test out an anti-ship missile.
Steven says that despite those concerns, driverless ships could be critical in responding to a Chinese blockade of Taiwan. Commander Daly says the unmanned surface vehicles should be fully integrated into the U.S. military in the next few years. Jessica Stone, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Jessica. Pakistan is bracing for possible violence ahead of a planned march on the capital city of Islamabad by former Prime Minister Imran Khan and thousands of his supporters on Friday. Khan announced the march from eastern city of Lahore is to push for early elections. Tension is rising in the city as the authorities deploy dozens of security personnel and blocked all road access. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gal.
The government has warned Imran Khan that his march will not be allowed to enter the capital city. And secondly, around 30,000 police and paramilitary forces have already been deployed in key areas of the city, which shows the kind of tension that are prevailing in the official circles. And government also approached the Supreme Court this morning to request the court to stop Imran Khan from marching on the Capitol, saying that it's going to undermine the diplomatic mission, security of key areas. But the Supreme Court rejected that plea from the government, saying that holding a peaceful march is the right of every Pakistani. So that shows that the government has tried its best to somehow discourage Mr. Khan from going ahead with this long-promised long march. But right now is that the government is prepared to deal with it if it comes to a situation where, you know, they would want to use force in case the protesters do something nasty. But on the other hand, Imran Khan has long prepared ground for this situation or this march that he announced yesterday.
Some supporters of former Prime Minister Imran Khan fear that he may be arrested. What is the possibility of this happening ahead of this Friday's march?
There was a possibility of him being arrested, but he played smartly because he made the announcement from the eastern city of Lahore, from where he says the march will begin. But after making that announcement, he has not come back to Islamabad to spend the rest of the time in his private residence, fearing that he could be arrested. And Lahore, you know, it's the capital of the Punjab province, where Imran Khan's party is part of the ruling coalition. So there is no fear there for this opposition leader to be arrested.
Analysts say it's almost certain it's going to be violent. How does the government balance protecting lives and property and allowing citizens to express their democratic rights?
In all the rallies that Imran Khan's party has held nationwide, that they would disperse peacefully. So from their side, we haven't seen any violent activity ever since Imran Khan was removed from office in April. There are so many forces active. There are militant groups which are active in Pakistan, and there could be forces that would want to create tension between the government and the protesters. So from the government side, apparently it has been a promise that they would allow any peaceful protest without any problem. But if Imran Khan this time is able to bring like even 200,000 people with his march, controlling the situation on that particular day when there is a possibility of any subversive act will be a serious challenge for the government.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gaur speaking with me from Islamabad. Gunmen have attacked a major Shiite holy site in Iran, killing at least 15 people and wounding dozens. Wednesday's attack came as thousands of protesters elsewhere in Iran marked a symbolic 40 days since the death of a woman in custody, ignited the biggest anti-government movement in over a decade. State TV blamed the attack on Sunni Muslim extremists who have targeted the country's Shiite majority in the past. It appeared to be unrelated to the demonstrations. The official website of the judiciary says two gunmen were arrested and a third is on the run after the attack on the Shacharagh Mosque, the second holiest site in Iran. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. More frequent and severe droughts in Africa are hampering food production, especially in arid parts of the continent, where farmers struggle to eke out a living. A water retention system developed in the United States is helping African farmers fight the trend and improve crop yields in drought-affected areas. Juma Majanga reports from Kibwezi, Kenya.
Under the scorching sun in the Ulilinzi village of southeastern Kenya, farmers are engaging in unique land preparations. They are installing in the ground specially designed polyethylene membranes that look like clear covers to prevent the loss of moisture and nutrients from the soil, exacerbated by drought from climate change. The sandy soils in this area, like in most arid and semi-arid areas, has made it nearly impossible to produce abundant crops. However, this new water retention technology developed in the U.S. is giving farmers here new hope. Alvin Smucker is a professor of soil biophysics at the Michigan State University who developed the technology.
We had a lot of government funding into the millions and millions of dollars to put all of this whole system together and then test it in Texas, Arizona, California, and Michigan. And these were all four universities that worked with us. So this is not something we put in a little container in the backyard, my backyard, and now we're saying it's the best in the world. It's been tested.
Shem Kuya, a researcher at the Jomo Kenyatta University of Agriculture and Technology, is one of the scientists leading the trials of the technology in Kenya.
We have tested the technology with cowpea. We have also tested the technology with maize. And we realized that farms where we had installed these membranes were more productive.
The technology has so far been tested in Zimbabwe and Kenya and is getting good reviews. Florence Mutisia, a farmer in Ulilinzi village, has deployed the technology in her farm. She says when the technology came, she was trained on how to make her sandy soil farm fertile. I saw the benefits and deployed it in my farm. And I can say that this technology is working very well because now I get good harvest, she adds. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Kibwezi, Kenya.
The World Health Organization warns fungal pathogens are a major and growing threat to public health, and more research is needed to strengthen global response to antifungal resistance. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Not all the many thousands of fungi circulating around the world are important, but those that are can be deadly, especially at a time when antimicrobial drug resistance is growing. For the first time, the World Health Organization has published a list of 19 so-called fungal priority pathogens that represent the greatest threat to global public health. The WHO reports antibacterial drug resistance causes 5 million indirect deaths and 1.3 million direct deaths a year. Officials say they do not know how many of the deaths are due to fungal pathogens. Hatim Sati is project and report technical lead for AMR coordination at the WHO. He says treatment options are limited and often toxic. He notes there are four classes of antifungal medicine currently available. Each contains multiple drugs. He adds few candidate drugs are in the clinical pipeline.
A lot of these drugs work with most of these fungal pathogens. However, these drugs are not without an issue. These drugs are associated with a lot of side effects. A lot of them are associated with resistance, and that leaves a limited number of options available for treatment and for the future in case resistance is increasing.
The WHO reports common infections such as Candida auris, in which the fungus accumulates on the lining of the mouth, or vaginal thrush, are becoming increasingly resistant to treatment. Director of AMR Global Coordination at WHO, Haile Jesus Getahun, says people most at risk of invasive fungal infections include those with tuberculosis, cancer, HIV/AIDS, and patients in hospital ICUs or intensive care units.
The COVID pandemic has also revealed the challenge that we faced with this, you know, fungal infections, that most COVID patients, particularly those who were in the treatment, particularly in the ICU units, were also developed fungal infections as a side illness.
The WHO warns fungal diseases are expanding worldwide due to global warming and the increase of international travel and trade. The authors of the report say they need more data and more evidence to better understand the burden of disease and antifungal resistance. They say that information is critical to understanding the magnitude of the growing threat and the actions that must be taken in response. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including 30 House of Representative progressive Democrats are calling on President Biden to shift his strategy on Ukraine ahead of midterm elections to pursue direct diplomacy with Russia to end the months-long conflict. We'll examine this and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Communist Party leader Xi Jinping tightens his grip on power as he secures an unprecedented third term at the recent 20th Party Congress. The new Politburo is also stacked with Xi loyalists, marking a continued shift away from collective leadership toward a personalized dictatorship. Two China experts discuss the domestic and international implications of Xi Jinping's unconstrained power next on The Voice of America. Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Haiti in freefall. Criminal gangs are plunging the country into chaos by blocking the main fuel terminal, engaging in kidnappings, assassinations, looting, rapes, and the destruction of property. We speak with Keith Mines of the U.S. Institute of Peace about how to best address the deteriorating political, economic, and security situation in Haiti next on Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and issues in the news on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinedu Ofor in Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States will live up to its commitments in the Indo-Pacific. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said in a recent interview, "We continue to work to make sure that we have the right capabilities in the right places to ensure that we help our allies maintain a free and open Indo-Pacific." When asked about the People's Republic of China's increased military activity and incursions into the Taiwan Strait, Secretary of Defense Austin said, "China is moving to establish what we would call a new normal. We saw a number of centerline crossings of the Taiwan Strait by their aircraft, and that number has increased over time. We've seen more activity in their surface vessels in the waters in and around Taiwan." The defense secretary stressed that the United States does not want to see a unilateral change to the status quo regarding Taiwan, and that the One China policy of the United States has not changed. He noted that in accordance with the Taiwan Relations Act, we're committed to helping Taiwan develop the capability to defend itself, and that work has gone on over time. It will continue into the future. Last month on her trip to Asia, Vice President Kamala Harris underscored the same commitment in her remarks aboard the USS Howard in Yokosuka, Japan. She noted the PRC's disturbing behavior in the East China Sea and in the South China Sea, and most recently provocations across the Taiwan Strait. "We will continue to oppose any unilateral change to the status quo," the vice president said, "and we will continue to support Taiwan's self-defense consistent with our longstanding policy." Taiwan, she stated, is a vibrant democracy that contributes to the global good, from technology to health and beyond, and the United States will continue to deepen our unofficial ties. The United States does not seek conflict or a Cold War with the PRC. "In fact," said Vice President Harris, "we will work with every willing nation to solve global challenges." "The United States is a proud Pacific power," the vice president declared. "The presence of the United States in the Indo-Pacific is in pursuit of peace and stability and to support our allies and partners."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.